Hey, everybody, welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecrack's movie podcast.
Show me the meaning!
was that your Jack Demon baby, Show Me the Meaning?
I keep trying to get as close to Tom Cruise and Jerry Maguire as possible, and I feel like...
But doesn't he say closer. It more than once?
He does, a bunch of different ways.
Yeah, okay.
So this is one of the quicker ways.
I like changing it up. Anyway, my name is Jared. I'm joined here by the Show Me the Meaning crew, who you can all already hear. We got Ryan...
Hey, film fans.
And Austin.
Yo.
And Greg.
What's up?
So today we're breaking down the new movie that came out this past weekend, The Incredibles 2, starring Helen Hunt and Craig T. Nelson, written and directed by Brad Bird. But before we go around and see what everyone talked about it, I want to ask everybody, please, if you have the time, leave us a review on iTunes. It makes a huge difference to us. It allows us to grow. It means a lot to... you know, our sponsors and everything. It makes a huge difference. So I actually want to give a shout out to a couple people who have given us a review recently. One guy named A Bucks Regular. He says, after years of enjoying Wisecrack videos, I'm really enjoying this podcast. So thank you, Bucks Regular. This is from Mars265. I enjoy the videos you guys put up on the regular. Now I can listen to you guys discuss movie themes and hidden messages. Thanks. You're welcome. And this last one is from Joseph Maltby. He says, this is a really fun way to hear different ideas about all the things your favorite movies are trying to say. I've definitely learned a lot about film and about these filmmakers from listening. Well, thank you, Joseph. We certainly try.
Thanks, Maltby.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, let's go around and what did you guys think of this movie? And also, before you say what you thought about Incredibles 2, tell us what you think about Incredibles 1 and your relationship with that movie. Let's start with Greg.
Wait, real quick, do we need to say spoilers? It's assumed.
Oh,
but...
sure. Yeah, all right, spoilers from now on. We're keeping it.
Yeah, but this is like a new this is like a new film, so I feel like it's etiquette. I don't know. Fuck etiquette.
Well, how about we just keep the review section spoiler free?
Sure.
Or just like the thoughts, and then after the recap, or before the recap,
the whole thing is a spoiler.
All right. Let's stop trying. All right, spoilers. Greg, what do you think?
Look, man, I love the Incredible franchise. I can say that now since it's two. I think it's dope. The first one, you know, Pixar, I'm a Bay Area dude. I like all the themes of San Francisco. But, you know, I like superheroes. I know I shit on like all the Marvel and DC movies, but I'm an animation guy. Like, if you did Aquaman in animation, I'm going to the movies to watch that shit. I like people drawing shit. I like computers. I like CGI. I like all that shit. I like the story. I just dug Incredibles. I loved Incredibles 2. I loved Lil Jack-Jack. I love the whole theme of it. You know, I love the feminist theme of it, and then the backfire feminist theme of it. It was dope. I was well entertained. It's sad that it took 17, how many long? 17
14.
Years?
14.
14 years, I'm sorry. I exaggerate. It took too long for another one, but hopefully it won't take too long for Incredibles 3. And can Frozone get a fucking movie? God damn.
What the
fuck we got to do?
I wanted more Frozone's wife, personally.
We only got like two scenes of that.
It is kind of cool how she's only an off-screen character,
That's
though.
That's perfect.
Yeah.
That's how I like my black woman.
Cool. Let's go with Ryan next.
Love Incredibles 1. And then this one I'd say was good enough. Overall, I didn't love it as much, for sure. I think it kind of fell into a lot of, I'd call, sequel traps, where the direction they took it didn't really, I feel like, expand on the first one that much. It just kind of was like another adventure. I liked a lot of it, though. I like I said, good enough. There was cool stuff in it. I left satisfied, you know. But overall, I didn't think it had as much of the magic. Brad Bird, though. My hero. I want to throw that out there.
Yeah.
That he's an OG.
That dude's a gangster. All right. What about you, Austin?
It's so strange. I always wonder who's going to say what about their impressions of the film. I thought that this would be right up Ryan's alley. I dug it. I really liked it.
Really?
I briefly was chatting about it with a buddy of mine on Facebook. I think this film may be better than the first one.
Nah.
Yeah, I think it was really interesting. I thought it was thematically interesting. I thought it was hilarious. I thought some of the visuals were really clever and you know, they did a lot of things where they like kind of scaled up a little bit, like they would do, like you tend to see in action sequels, right? Like it's more destruction or more damage. And then in some ways it was very restrained too. So I don't know. I really dug it.
All right. So I am on the same wavelength as Austin. And I think that I like this more than the first one only because, similar to with The Matrix Reloaded, like this movie is fucking smart and profound. And I think it's the message of this film, I think, is so important for today, about what it says about media, about it, what it says about the way that we interact with screens, and ultimately what it even says about superheroes. Austin, did you happen to see the quick take we released today on it?
I did. I watched it before I went to sleep. And it's so funny because I literally tweeted, "Screenslaver was right, don't at me," before I saw the quick take. And there was kind of some interesting musings. Wasn't that the title of the video? Like, was the villain right?
Yeah, maybe I plagiarized you. I don't know.
It's all good, brother. In the era of meta-modern internet mixing, it's all free.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think that all the things I liked about the first one, this one had. I mean, I love the family. I actually really like Violet's subplot a lot. Yeah. I liked all the awkward boy moments with her. And there's really nothing that I didn't like about it. And then the villain Screenslaver is so interesting. And once again, I think that the message or the overall conceit around the conflict surrounding him is the most relevant thing that we could be talking about in 2018.
Her. Screenslaver. Her, right?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Screenslaver, what?
Her.
Screenslaver's a girl.
It's a woman.
Oh, did I say he?
She's the pizza female
delivery man that she brainwashes. Okay. Or I don't know. Yeah. It's hard for me to, yeah, but you're absolutely right. Okay. So let's go into a quick recap. Seconds after the end of the first film finds the Incredibles facing off against the Underminer, who gets away, leaving the Incredibles exposed and the public angry about the collateral damage. As a result, the problematic nature of supers is catapulted into the news cycle, and things are looking dismal for the Incredibles. Until Frozone comes to them with an offer from billionaires Winston Deber and his sister Evelyn, who plan to use their media empire to change the public's perception of supers and eventually change the law outlawing them. Helen is recruited to be the public face of supers under Dever's new initiative, while Mr. Incredible struggles with taking care of Violet's boy problems, Dash's math problems, and Jack-Jack's budding badassery. Helen comes face to face with Screenslaver, who uses screens to hypnotize people in an attempt to ruin the public image of supers. It's later revealed that Screenslaver is actually Evelyn mind controlling a pizza delivery man, and her mission is to reverse the intent of her brother's efforts and undermine the validity and benevolence of supers by mind controlling them and broadcasting them doing horrible things. When Bob, Helen, and Frozone fall under Evelyn's hypnosis, it's up to Dash, Violet, and Jack-Jack to save the day. In the end, the Incredibles thwart Evelyn's plan, the law gets reversed, and Evelyn goes to jail. But, as Violet notes, she'll probably only be there for about 2 years since she's rich. End of movie.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know ya at a deeper level. The who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
All right, so let's start this conversation talking about the villain, Screenslaver. What did you guys think of Screenslaver?
I thought Screenslaver was dope. I thought it was a good villain. I liked the whole brainwashing aspect of it. One thing that I felt like doing during the Screenslaver scenes, it was so much going on that I really couldn't focus on the words that he was saying. I mean, that she was saying. I know she was talking about a lot about the themes of, you know, this is our problems. We watched too much of this. And I heard her, you know, I was watching so much of the graphics and what was going on instead of really listening to the words.
I agree. That's why, Jared, when you said that it's a really important message, I kind of felt like it was a pretty like cliche-ly conveyed message, you know? Yeah, because it was just, it sounded like a bunch of
gibberish.
Kind of, yeah, like stuff that sounded important, but mm-hmm. I couldn't really, I was trying to follow it. And I think at the end of the day, I do think I got what the whole point of the thing was, but I want to know what you feel like the point of the mission is.
All right, so what I think that this movie is about is, so it's about, it's about mediated images. It's about the image of superheroes and the idea how, like,
perception,
exactly. So, you know, at the beginning, we learned that the superheroes were taken down by a PR problem. The public perception of superheroes was formed by the images of them that circulate in the media. So, like, basically, Winston says to them, like, the images that you see on the screen of superheroes surrounded by destruction is what condemns them. The fact that they were trying to stop this destruction is irrelevant. They were associated with it, thus people viewed them negatively. So on one level, this is just basically like, okay, yeah, it's just PR, right? Like the importance of PR, the very cynical, like hyper-relevance of PR in that it's almost more important than reality. So Winston wants to revamp the superhero brand by creating like a curated reality of superheroes to be consumed by Americans. It's also very relevant that this media mogul can basically change a law within like 2 months, not by lobbying, but by just showing images, you know, by basically just like using your media empire to show people. And in that sense, like what Screenslaver does by hypnotizing people is kind of done less literally by Winston, in the same way that I could say that, you know, all the people that have those goggles on are hypnotized to do whatever they're saying. We could say the same thing about all the people watching TV who all of a sudden see Helen on a bike saving the day, which is what she's always done. But now, because it is on a screen and being, you know, communicated to the masses through mass media, they're being brainwashed just as much. And now you could argue that, oh, well, but they're being brainwashed into accepting a positive message because the Incredibles truly are positive people. But I think that's missing the point. The point is that people are manipulated by these mediated images and the actual reality of it is not really relevant. And one of the most interesting parts about this is that there's a part in the movie where Evelyn and Helen are arguing. I don't remember what they're at, like some sort of a party or like they're where the other superheroes are like being introduced. And I don't even know how they get into this conversation, but it seemed like kind of this thematic thing that was just placed where Evelyn asks Helen, like, what's more important, the selling of an object or the actual object itself? And they argue about this.
I thought that was a really interesting scene. And,
right.
And it was really cool when Helen is like, you know, selling's actually
more
important. You don't expect the protagonist to say something like that because that's usually not in a movie.
See, that
kind of comes down to, like, Brad Bird's pretty business. I mean, he's a pretty white right-wing guy. I don't know if that comes through to you.
I don't. Well, the interesting thing is we talked about that in the first one. I don't really think that this is like a right wing or even like a. The reason why I like this so much is because, as some of you know, I'm like a technophobe. I am like, there's a reason I don't have fucking Twitter. You know, I think that most internet technology is really bad for us. And I love how this movie is a movie for kids that is giving us this critical message about how media affects us.
Yeah, I love that part too.
So basically the whole movie is basically saying that, like, look, and I also think that this isn't cynical. I think this is like post-cynical. The idea that how things seem are more important than how they are, like the mediated image of an object or a superhero is more important than the real object or the real person. Like, I don't even think that's cynical anymore. I think that's just true.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying, is that he acknowledges these truths kind of like, look, like there's a utilitarian aspect to selling. Like, it's about persuading ideas, you know, and it's not just exploitation. It can be used for exploitation. But yeah, I am impressed with Brad Bird putting these like pretty heavy topics in a kids movie.
So the most interesting thing about this is when this idea is then connected to superheroes. So Evelyn, who is Screenslaver, says that the reason why she's doing this and she's trying to get people to distrust superheroes is because they made her father docile. They made him think that he would be saved by superheroes instead of taking matters into his own hands and hiding in the safe room. So here I think the movie does something interesting in that there's that like epic monologue. I this is what Greg was talking about. I wish I wrote down what she said, yeah. But like Screenslaver says something like, you know, all of our meaningful experiences, like, or we don't even have meaningful experiences anymore. Like, we don't go anywhere. We just watch travel shows. You know, we don't try anything new. We just watch reality television. And I think that when Screenslaver or Evelyn then transitions this to talk about superheroes, a very interesting commentary is being made about the effect of superhero movies on us. Mm-hmm. So the movie directly asks the question, like, in the same way that Evelyn's father said, oh, superheroes will save me, so therefore he gets killed, do we not also, when we watch superhero movies through a screen, do we not also say that, like, oh, you know, I'm not going to actually try to, you know, stand up for any justice, or, you know, why should I need to do anything to fix the world when there are heroes out there to do it for me? And I think that, you know, we talked about in our Deadpool 2 podcast how I didn't think Deadpool was subversive at all. This movie is fucking subversive because it's a superhero movie that questions the possibly harmful effect of superhero movies. And I think at the end when Violet says, you know, like, we have this happy ending, you know, the law is reversed, the incredible save the day, Evelyn gets thrown in jail. But then Violet says, like, yeah, but she's rich. She's only going to get 2 years in jail. And I think the movie's asking us to say that, yes, we're tempted to think that, oh, man, superheroes save the day. We can all go home and eat Cheetos and fall asleep and think that the world is all good. But the truth is, Violet's hinting at the fact that, nope, don't let these superhero images make you docile like they did Evelyn's father. There's still injustices out there, and this movie should not keep you docile.
Well, but do you, I mean, are you implying that our, in real life, addiction to superhero movies makes us think that somehow that there's actually superheroes?
No. Like, so Bill Maher made this argument that I don't necessarily agree with, but it's one that can be made. He made this argument like about a year ago. He was lamenting the fact that superhero movies have basically dominated movies in the box office. And it's kind of a leap of logic, but he made the argument that, like, you know, he made the possible argument that if we worship superheroes, then we might worship somebody, this strong individual, to solve all our problems. And then an image of Trump comes up.
I feel like that's such a stretch, though.
I would agree.
Yeah.
But I think that do we really think that there's people with superpowers? No. But we might think that, like, there are benevolent individuals out there. And that's the key word, individuals. You know, instead of what really causes change, what really causes, you know, progress to be made is people coming as a collective, as a group, and coming together. And I think that you could argue that when we worship superheroes, we believe that, no, it's all about the individual. The individual is going to save us.
Yeah, and I think that's the interesting thing. So, like, when I talk about whether or not there are superheroes of the left or anything like that, this really gets to the heart of it. You know, it's concerned with community that is transforming the social system itself, right? Or a community of people coming together and somehow living in cooperation to change the way that social life itself is lived. And the problem with so much of superhero logic is that it isn't about that. It's about maintaining the status quo, because the status quo isn't ultimately changed in these films. I mean, I shouldn't say never, but it's very rarely ever changed. And it's always reactionary to that, or it's mostly, I should say, reactionary to that, because it's about this one person's individual quote-unquote moral fiber. But of course, it's really an enhanced super moral fiber. Either they're committed to it, like some sort of cause, or they have some sort of duty-bound responsibility that's imposed upon them to change the system, because, you know, to whomever great gifts are given or great power is given comes great responsibility, whatever, blah, 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 right? So there's like this symptomatic docility that is instilled into the communities of Gotham and to San Francisco and various others, because the people just simply become passive observers. And so the question is can you still have a superhero genre film that breaks outside of, you know, these individuals who are these exceptional figures and who are merely reactive to these aberrations in this society, and that the people in the society just want to go about their daily lives or go about their business and ignore? Or is there a way that we could say, fuck, man, what if we were still doing something within the superhero genre, but at the same time, we're challenging the very framework itself and trying to say you know, wait a minute, what if we try to change our system? Or what if we rose up together and didn't outsource our problems to other individuals, but we took that power ourselves as a community and started changing the way that the world actually is? And I think that's kind of the crux of the issue. And then all the other stuff is really just a symptom of that being the crux of the issue.
See, I kind of half agree with you guys and half disagree. I do think that there is kind of this... The part I disagree with is that I don't think that this is an anti-individualism movie. Like the kind of like in the first movie, they still talk about the, you know, like, hey, we're gifted, exceptional people that we should, and we shouldn't be restrained by society, you know, which I do think is Brad Bird.
But isn't that so interesting how maybe it's like a reversal?
See, what I do think, yeah, and it is interesting, and that's why I think that it's almost like. Like, I feel like the superheroes are kind of a metaphor for, yeah, very gifted people in society. And it's almost like a, I feel like in the last episode we talked about him being an objectivist, you know.
Yeah.
I feel like this is like a reverse Atlas Shrugged situation where it's like the quote-unquote normal, unexceptional people have to go, God, we can't just rely on these super exceptional people to pull us out of every bind we get in. We got to pull together too, you know.
Well, the interesting thing is they don't actually show that. You know, it's weird how
they don't show people being brainwashed, really, aside from them being actually brainwashed. But in terms of, I wish there was more people watching game shows and not playing games or
whatever.
Well,
there's an interesting part where, like, you know, right before Jack-Jack fights the raccoon, he only does so because he just saw on the television screen, he saw a criminal with a mask that made him look like a raccoon. And then he looks outside the screen and he says, oh, look, a raccoon. And then he starts fighting him.
Well, it's learned behavior. You know, so many people say that art imitates life or that art is a reflection of life. And I think that's an oversimplistic way of looking at things because there's like this dialectical, symbiotic, co-constitutive relationship where, sure, in some ways, art is a reflection of the human experience. But at the same time, we also imitate what we see, for example, on TV. I mean, like, how many people live overdramatic Kardashian wannabe lives because they see the images on the screen that they then want to emulate?
Me!
And I think one of my fears and something I often wonder is how deep does that tendency towards imitation of the images that were fed on our screen actually run and actually constitute the way that we think about the world and the way we feel? And I sometimes sit back in social settings and I'll be like, man... Like, you guys are all just fucking fakers, man. Like, you're saying the same shit that you saw on Love Island or The Bachelor or some bullshit drama TV show. And I'm like, it doesn't even seem real. You know, you're manufacturing some bullshit drama to make your life seem more interesting. And I just wonder how deep that really runs. And this is where, even though I think that Screenslaver was right to a degree, I actually disagree with him or her to an extent. Because I think that... And here's a question, too, like, real quick before I finish. Where exactly does Screensaver end and Evelyn begin? Like, is the pizza delivery boy's identity? Because she doesn't continue that same sort of attack once the pizza delivery boy is arrested, right? Like the identity, at least in the forefront, seems to shift. Because no longer is she bad-mouthing our docility because we're attached to our screens and live through mediated images. But it sort of turns just into a more classic revenge story at that point.
But, I mean, if it was just a classic revenge story, then she would want to kill the supers, but she doesn't. She wants to tear down their image so that they will never be able to,
PR wars.
Right, exactly.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. And yeah, because it's ultimately based on the effects that the mediated images had on her parents, which caused their deaths because they were passive instead of just being practical and going into the safe room or whatever it was. Okay, that makes sense. But where I think...
All this is making me like the movie a lot more, by the way.
Yeah, see, this is what happens when you get together with homies and talk about shit. You're like, man, I didn't like The Matrix Reloaded. And then you're like, well, actually, it's kind of interesting.
Has that been sitting with you better, Austin?
Matrix Reloaded?
Yeah, man.
Okay, cool.
Not me. I mean, since you guys have been talking about like the Hollywood aspect of it with these superhero movies and the effect on... regular viewers, what if the movie was actually talking to Hollywood and saying that these superhero movies, I know they're going to sell, but they are making us weak. They're making Hollywood weak. You're making these movies, you know people are hypnotized by these movies, you're making so much money, But the real talented movies that we aren't creating, we're not doing anything with. And we're depending on these movies. We're becoming weak because of these movies that we just keep pushing out. And sooner or later, the audience is going to get tired of these movies. So maybe that, you know, maybe the movie was, you know, was shifted towards
a cautionary tale for Hollywood.
I think there's something in there. Yeah. I think that is probably too subtle for most people in Hollywood that make decisions to get it. Yeah. But no, I agree. Let me ask you guys, like, when Violet said that line about, like, oh, well, she's probably just going to be out into here because she's rich, like, how did that affect you? Because I didn't know what to think about it at first.
Kind of like I was saying before, it made me think that Brad Bird, you know, who wrote the whole movie, right, mind you, he's real. He keeps it real. And it made me go, wow, that's in a kid movie. I'm glad that they're really acknowledging that the villain isn't going to stay, you know.
It's rare that any superhero movie that, you know, like, is building up to its happy ending, like, basically in the resolution, less than a minute before the movie ends, she says, like, yeah, we didn't really make much of a difference. The system still sucks.
Yeah, it's crazy.
You know, that's crazy.
I thought it was weird. I was like, why did she say that?
Yeah. You know, like, I was trying to have a good time.
I was like,
killed my buzz.
I was like calculating in my head. I was like, well, wait a minute. Like, what did she do? And would she really get out? And I found myself sitting there thinking, like, even if she's that rich, well, maybe she'll go away for like 10 years or something, or maybe fucking not. I don't know.
She'll be in a white collar.
Well, she's kind of been the moral compass of this movie, though, a little bit.
Violet?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, she was my favorite character in this movie. Yeah. She was awesome.
And how in the beginning, the dude was like bigging her up. Like, yeah, she's so confident now. And, like, you know, he was really into her. Tony? Yeah.
Tony.
Yeah.
So in terms of me saying that I think that this is a really, really important message, I hope that this message gets out to people, because obviously in the age of fake news, post-fact, it's really important for people to be skeptical of things that they see in the media, or just like to be able to recognize that there is a disparity between how things seem through images when you see an object on the TV and the actual object. And that's why, like, I want to give Brad Bird like a fucking Nobel Prize for, you know, like, in the same way that when we discussed Inside Out, we talked about like how it's so awesome that these days you can have a kid who is who's too scared to jump off the diving board, but then he says to himself, now wait, the fear is just like this thing in my mind that is informing me not to do something, but I can choose to usurp that. Like, the idea that a 4-year-old kid can conceive of that after watching Inside Out is awesome, and I'm hoping that this movie will have a similar effect on kids, in which they'll actually be able to be critical about, you know, about images, because unfortunately these images, whether it's on your phone, on your TV, in a movie theater, it ain't going away.
But do you think it was too deep? We can pick this up, but do you think the kids will be able to see through it like that?
No. I don't know. Maybe on some level.
Yeah.
And here's another thing. When I said it earlier, it's kind of cliche. I mean, maybe I just consume too much media, but I feel like for like 6 years I've been hearing people say, God, you know, people are just looking at their phones too much.
Yeah.
No complaining. I guess it's always going to be with us, like that complaint, but kind of at this point I'm like, just shut the fuck up. We all get it. Everyone's on their phones. It sucks, but it's our reality. I mean...
Right, so at that point, all you can do is imbue a critical disposition and say, all right, if you're going to be on your phone, at least be aware
that
you know, you're not, you know, like, yeah, like, it's not reality that you're consuming, and that you need to be critical about these things.
Agree.
So here's where Screenslaver is wrong, though, is that the implication is sort of nostalgic, that somehow there used to be a time when we were connected to the real, but now we're not because we're only connected to mediated images. And I would argue that that itself is a nostalgic fantasy for a time that never was. Now, Baudrillard, who a lot of people, and how you in the Quick Take video, compared Screenslaver to, and I don't think you couldn't make that comparison, I mean, he literally is an almost parody of certain interpretations of Baudrillard, but Baudrillard does think that there was a time of what he calls symbolic exchange, where we didn't live in an era of virtual reality or hyperreality or just like the radical proliferation of mediated images. And in his...
It's called the caveman days, right?
Well, yeah, it is basically. Like in primitive societies, as he would have said, or like in The Savage Mind, which is a book by Claude Lévi-Strauss. I know the term kind of sucks for PC ears, but, you know, he's writing in the 50s or 60s when they weren't as quote-unquote woke as we are now. But there was a time prior to the emergence of certain modes of exchange based on common currency or under the conditions of capitalism or whatever. But Baudrillard did believe that there may have been a time of... there may have been a time of symbolic exchange where you really were engaging with the real. But most people don't think of him in that way. Most people are just familiar with his later work in which, you know, he's talking about simulation, where things are just copies of copies of copies, and we live in this alienated, simulated existence. And the problem with that for me is that I don't know if there was ever a time when we were connected to the real, or if we can ever be fully connected to the real, because I think language ultimately separates us from being able to access the real as it is in itself. You know, does that make sense?
It makes sense, but that's not to say that things haven't gotten worse. Can we say that?
Well, I mean, what do you mean worse? So say you're an indigenous person, and instead of mediating your existence through superhero images, instead it's being mediated, our lives are being mediated through the Gilgamesh tale, right? And so, you know, I go out and I start to gather food and it starts raining and I start thinking about Gilgamesh or Noah or whatever the fucking flood story is that your culture listens to, or the story of my people or whatever, and I'm engaging in a particular activity because, you know, I'm anticipating being accepted into my community formally as a member and as an adult or whatever, through some sort of rite of passage. And so all my experiences are still mediated through memories, through images that constitute my consciousness. And the difference is that they're not, I mean, the only difference is that they're not externalized.
And so I think that the difference is convenience, is that through screens, like the ability for us to get that dopamine hit and to, you know, like forget a problem is just increased when, like, literally on our phone we have infinite amounts of hours of distraction. So, like, yes, I agree with your point, but I think that, like, the docility is increased with technology.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm making a somewhat academic point where I'm trying to say, hey, let's not fool ourselves into thinking that somehow we had it better and that somehow we've lost it. You know, I do agree with you, though, but I'd say it's more a difference of degree than a difference of kind. That's the only thing I'd say, and that's just because I'm being nitpicky.
Well, that's what I'm saying, worse, better, so it is degree.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Again, even saying worse, though, it's making a value judgment. You know, is it worse?
I think it's worse just because it's in our hands. Like, we could get away at one point, you know? We could go outside and, I mean, we'll see billboards and shit like that, our music on the radio. But now this shit is, like, basically attached to us. We got watches. It's everywhere. You can't get away from it.
I mean, so, yeah, the idea that post-fact is now something that people know about, that that's like outside of academic circles, that it's like that it's inundated our reality. I mean, obviously this is worse, right, than before. Now, you could argue that we never had that access to reality, but the fact that it's so obvious now that facts are these things that no one can even agree on anymore, that has to be a worse degree, right?
Well, but before, facts were concentrated and controlled by a small group of people, and maybe we were just ignorant to this supposed illusion of capital T truth that we were living with then. I mean, this is something that Chomsky talks about in Manufacturing Consent, right? Which was written right around the shift towards the time that we consider now as being this age of radically proliferated, mediated images. But still, his point was that there are like four or five small companies that are really dictating the news that disseminated to the hundreds of national, regional, and local news outlets what they could report. So basically, they're all saying the same thing, right? And they're just mediated, collated images that are, you know, edited carefully according to the interests of these big media conglomerates who control the narrative. I mean, look at why has weed been illegal in America? You know, it's been illegal because the newspaper magnates were afraid that hemp was going to be used to replace paper, and alcohol lobbies knew it had cut into their profits. So, again, the narrative has always been controlled by those who are in power. And then let's even go back further than that. Like, you know, why was the Catholic Church selling indulgences? Well, they were the ones with power, with knowledge power. They were able to control what was thought and how it was thought, what was true, what was not true, how was truth determined. Here are the keys to the kingdom, to happiness. Otherwise, you're going to be enslaved to sin unless you're a good Catholic and give us money and get your loved ones out of purgatory by paying us. So there's always been this tendency, right? So I guess I'm just skeptical of this, like, it's like we're worse now and we had it better before narrative. I mean, I just think the human experience is basically fucked.
No, I agree with Jared that we're worse, but I don't agree that it... I agree for different reasons. The reason that it's worse now, because I do think that it's always been kind of a post-fact. Like, perception's always been reality for forever.
Sure.
But it's so bad now because it's so transparent that it works on everybody. Like, because with the internet, we can see it. You know, Donald Trump is a perfect example. It's like everyone, you know, there's a whole big part of the population that's just like, what the fuck? How did he persuade you? You know what I mean? Like, and it must be fake news or whatever. I think it's the machine that we can all see is happening. We're all helpless and hopeless to stop it. And when, you know, on an individual level, when you talk to an individual, you know, it doesn't seem that bad, but then you look at the data and the statistics, the big data, and you're like, God, we're fucked, kind of.
You know? So that's an analogy for the movie. Like, it's a machine and you can't stop it. A
little bit.
Okay, all right.
The difference is between what Jared's boy Zizek says is the difference in the shift from ideology where it used
you
to be.
You just throw me under the bus, bro.
Nah, man, there's nothing wrong with that. It used to be.
Can't let your academic friends know that you like the Zizek.
Hey, man, I love me some Zizek still. But it used to be that we don't know that we're doing it, yet we're doing it, right? That's what ideology is for a lot of post-Freudian psychoanalysis. You don't realize that you're doing something, but you do it anyway. That's ideology. But then what Zizek says is that now that's not really what ideology is, that, or at least the novel version of ideology today. Now it's that we know that we're doing it, but we do it anyway. And that's what Ryan's talking about. It's like we're just fully immersed in it. And we just throw up our arms in resignation and say, fuck it, we're going to do it anyway. Even though we know it's stupid or wrong or banal or alienating or damaging somehow or whatever, but we do it anyway. And that's kind of the difference there. And that might even be more problematic than the we're unaware, but we're doing it version of ideology.
I mean, you could say that the message of this movie is largely that it's like, all right, so we're recognizing that superhero movies have a perhaps negative effect on people, but we're doing it anyway because this is what you guys want.
A little bit.
It's the moneymaker.
So I want to transition this conversation to nostalgia. So in the last podcast, we talked about The Incredibles 1. And we talked about how the film was like pro-nostalgia, that it affirmed nostalgia or the old school, that by the end of the movie, we had those two old guys who were saying, that's old school. Ain't no school like the old school. And we're all like, oh, man, things went back to the way they were in like the 60s or whenever the opening of The Incredibles came up.
Or as Austin says, the times that never were.
Everything has always sucked. So in this one, there's one point where Frozone says to the Incredibles, he's like, hey, you guys should wear your old suits because Winston is nostalgic. What did you guys think of that?
I thought that was a weird line, too. I always, you know, watching this movie, I'm like, I'm missing something. You know, it just felt like a lot of stuff was going over my head. But yeah, I thought this...
Well, did you forget that they had individual identities before they got married? I did. I mean, because that's the opening scene in the last one, right?
No.
Wedding?
Yeah, I remember that. But, I mean, when he said that part, it did bring it back up. But I was like, who's this? It just made me wonder about this guy. It made me not trust the brother and sister automatically.
Well, yeah, it definitely seemed like a weird... foreboding line, but then I don't feel like did it ever really come back again?
No, I mean this is an open question. I don't really have an answer here.
Yeah, because now that you bring that up, it seems like since they didn't bring it back, it seems like it is probably some sort of commentary, right, on nostalgia.
But it could be to Austin's point that, I mean, if we are to think that The Incredibles 2 is a reversal of The Incredibles 1, it could be that whereas The Incredibles 1 was like, okay, there are certain things that are better in the past, let's affirm nostalgia. This one is like, I don't know, I mean... I guess we need to ask ourselves, is Winston, no matter how good his intentions are to allow supers to exist in the world, should we, like, is it just that he wields too much power? You know what I'm saying? So, like, Winston, he's not the bad guy. He's not Evelyn, but what is he?
He's dumb.
He's a pawn in her system. Yeah. In her game.
Is it like, was it her idea? Do we ever learn that?
Yeah, remember, because they have the reverse view of that moment when their dad got killed. Remember?
Right. Yeah.
And
but they both have the same philosophy in that we will change reality, or we will change the world through our media empire, because everything is about perception.
So you're saying who is the seed of the idea?
I don't think it, no, I'm really just asking, Evelyn is bad, but is Winston necessarily good? Because I mean, it's just like,
yeah, I think he's good. He's the salesman.
But I'm just asking, like, does he not wield just too much power? Like, it's just almost like a good. First of all, I think there's a question to be asked, like, now that supers are legal, is that good? And once again, it's just a coincidence that he wants to do something good. The real reality here is that Winston just decides one day, he's like, oh, I want to create a PR campaign to change a law, and he just fucking does it. And within 2 weeks, the law's changed.
He doesn't just decide it. He does it to help because of his dad, you know.
Well, whatever. That's his own personal thing. Like, who gives a shit? He could have a dog that died.
It was
a
very interesting story structural thing. It was very interesting, you know, because they do all this foreshadowing thing. You think he's a bad guy, and then, oh, no, he's a good guy.
Yeah.
Remember, he definitely is helping out with the resistance, you know, to Evelyn and stuff at the end.
I know, but the point is that that's just his opinion, yeah. You know, and now just whatever he wants to do, like if I wanted to change a law that makes it so that people in California all have to have gold toilets, like, and
oh,
I was
right.
him,
yeah, and he's breaking
I could
the
fucking
law to
do
that.
It. I could fucking do it just because, like, people, because as Winston proves, public opinion is very easily manipulated by the media.
No, I think they got real political at that point. You know, I think they were like saying, Republican, Democrat right there. You know, you're still playing on the same team. You know what I mean? Like, both of these guys are fucking rich. You know, they talk shit to each other, but they're eating dinner at the same restaurant next, the tables next door to each other. You know what I mean?
Well, that's what I like about this movie is that, like, it's, like, this is a problem for everybody.
Yeah.
Republican, Democrat, whatever.
Totally.
Well, yeah, it was so blatant how exuberant, how rich he was, right? Like, their building is fucking above the clouds. The house, one of his many houses, you know, that they make sure to focus on, that it's just one of his many houses, is ridiculously insane. The yacht that the superheroes all meet on is also fucking ridiculous. And it seems that they really did focus on the outlandishness of his wealth. And then tie that to how his wealth leads to his power and how he's able to get things done because he has so much wealth. And I think that's what Jared's saying. Like, yo, if I wanted to change the laws right now, I couldn't change the laws. But if I'm Elon Musk, you sure as fuck believe I can change some laws.
Yeah, that's the point. Like, is someone evil just because the amount of power that they have? Should someone not just have this much power, even if they're doing good?
It's like George Soros and the Koch brothers. You know, it's
sure.
like are they doing good or bad? You know, they're they think they're trying to spread their ideology, but you know, other people think, yeah, they're taking advantage. Right. But what I would say is that I look back at that conversation at the dinner table. Right, where they're all like talking about laws, you know, and Mr. Incredible's like, look, you know, just because it's a law doesn't mean it's a good thing,
yeah.
You know, which is a fair point, you know, and mm-hmm. and so I think that it's that's taking it to the extreme. You have this Elon Musk figure who can say, well, what, you know, what do I want to put my money to? I want to change this law that's important to me. I think Brad Bird is just bringing up this ethical question that you're bringing up right now,
mm-hmm.
but I don't think they really answer it. Cause like you say, money can be used for good. Money can be used for evil, like to get you out of jail when you're an evil piece of shit. Basically the point of the movie, it's a big take on rich people can get away with fucking anything.
It's like Austin said, we're all fucked.
it's not we're all fucked. It's just that you're way less fucked if you're rich.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so.
You only get 2 years in jail, like Violet says.
Right, exactly. See, I think that it's a pretty heavy-handed theme. I don't think that it's subtle at all. I think it's pretty clear. I don't think we're doing a deep read on it or anything like that. I think the wealth that is on display, the power that is on display, isn't something they're tiptoeing around. I think they're saying, look, this is a central theme of the designing principles of this film, and it's really about whoever has the money has the power and controls the narrative. And the fact that, what's his name again, the rich dude?
Winston.
Yeah, the fact that Winston, Bob Odenkirk, is able to, or Saul Goodman, is able to simply shift perception is because he has control of knowledge power, which is quite frightening. So we might be tempted to say, you know, maybe it is better that he's changing a dishonest narrative into a more honest narrative, because now we can live this virtual experience with the supers, and now we have the truth. But the question is this really the truth, or just another form of a manipulated image, just under the conditions of a different power structure? Whereas before it was the news media, or now it's this other guy who thinks that he somehow has the beat, which is really just based on a nostalgic love for superheroes, but a beat on what it really means to disseminate truthful images, which is quite, again, problematic, which is something I think we should think through, because, you know, it's something that exists in our world, you know, that, you know, you talk about Soros and the Koch brothers, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but it's just a fact that the Koch brothers are throwing their money around. You know, it's just a fact.
I don't believe you, Austin. I don't believe you're not a conspiracy theorist at all.
No,
George Soros paid you to say that.
I don't believe you,
bud. How much did George Soros pay you to say that, Austin?
Hey, I mean, I'm traveling the world, homie. You want to know how I fund myself, right? No. So Noam Chomsky says, it's not a conspiracy theory when two rich dudes in suits shake hands behind closed doors and make an agreement. Now, that's not a conspiracy theory. That's just two motherfuckers with power saying this is how we're going to make more money and get shit done. So, I don't know.
I think we can contextualize this as an interesting... if we think about the first one, and the message of the first one, as we talked about in our last podcast, is that exceptional people ought to be able to exercise their power, right?
Amen, motherfucker.
But what about rich... like, are rich people like Winston not also... Or Evelyn, is she not also exceptional? She is, you know, like, I mean, in the movie, they just inherited their wealth. They make that very clear.
Yep.
I think the more I'm thinking about this, I do think that The Incredibles 2 is an inversion of The Incredibles 1.
Yeah.
Because The Incredibles 1 said that, okay, if you're exceptional, you should be able to express your exceptional powers. And if you don't, society will suffer. This one is saying that if you are exceptional or in an exceptional position of power like Winston... if we do allow these people to express their powers, it could be a fucking problem, like Evelyn.
Well, it also is like, it doesn't matter how exceptional you are, it's just the perception of your exceptionalism is a...
Well, no, because Evelyn and Winston have cold, hard power. They control...
Because of their money.
They control perception. They're more... Yeah, well, it's not only their money... I think it's more, it's their money and the fact that they are media moguls, that they can control perception, that they control the screens, they control perspective. So, in a way, these motherfuckers are way more powerful than The Incredibles will ever be.
Right, but they have bad intentions, though, like Evelyn does. Right, so, I mean, yeah, I don't think that they would disagree that if you have a lot of power...
Well... Evelyn would say that she has good intentions. She's trying to make people less docile. You know, she's trying to say that
she's doing it in this sketchy way of creating giant disasters and stuff. I mean, she's a bad person.
Yeah, you can't pay women the same pay.
All right, I want to move into the mailbag. So we've actually got a couple questions about The Incredibles 2, so I want to address these first. So this is from Rue Brandon on Patreon.
What up, Rue?
Also, if you guys want to join us on Patreon, go to wisecrackplus.com. Anyway, so Rue Brandon says, did you guys see any themes of political libertarianism in The Incredibles 2?
Yeah, that's kind of what we've been talking about a little bit, or I feel like I talked
but
about it.
But so what did we conclude? We concluded that it's like, all right, here's libertarian message, and now we're inverting it. Now it's anti-libertarian.
It's not anti. I don't think it's anti-libertarianism. They still talk about exceptional people doing exceptional things and letting them be free to do it. But they still are saying that, A, there's a cost to that, because like you've been saying, these people. But then also, what do the normal people – I don't mean to say normal people, but what does your average citizen who's not a superhero, you know, how does the existence of your superhero – power and the perception of it affect them, you know, and it's about how they deal with it. That's what I got out of it.
I think that's
a weird kind of a libertarian message.
I think that there's something very cynical about the fact that in the first movie, we're like, okay, the law is unjust because the Incredibles are good people and they want to save the world. But in this one, it's not that the law doesn't get reversed because of that. The law just gets reversed because some rich guy wants it to be.
Well, but he persuaded the public with his media-ness. His
right,
media empire, I mean.
Right, but I mean, the point, maybe I'm the cynical one. I'm interested in what you think, Austin, but the point is it could have been anything. He could have convinced the public of anything.
Hey, look, if you had all your money and you did, and you said, hey, everyone, look, golden toilets, like you were saying before, and everyone's like, dude, yeah, why not golden toilets?
Yeah.
There's a good chance that everyone goes, fuck that. Well, I don't want this. I'm not going to sit on a golden toilet because this rich guy put a poster up. That could have been the reaction. You know, he's just a good PR guy. You know?
I mean, certainly not every. Yeah, but I think that perhaps what the movie is pointing to is that people, at least most people, are not very good at being being critical of the images they see, so
AKA easily brainwashed.
Easily brainwashed. Yeah. On both sides.
Of course.
I don't think Brad Bird disagrees with that.
Yeah. I don't know if I like this movie anymore.
Really?
Yeah.
Is it too depressing?
I like it more.
Yeah. Actually, I mean, just like, and then like with the graphics and the cartoon, it just makes me feel like, oh, I'm just being duped the whole time.
But yeah. Don't you think it's an important message for people?
Yeah, I think so. But I just feel like with the cartoon and with the beauty of this movie and with all these underlying messages underneath it.
Get out of my head, yeah, motherfucker.
Yeah, exactly,
yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like Bernard in Westworld, you know
you
what I mean? Like,
delete Ford.
Get out of this, man. I just want to swim, you know?
Can we all agree, though, that the best part of the movie was the fucking sentient dumpling short that played before the movie?
So
that
good.
How
amazing
was
that?
Austin, did you cry?
That was so good.
Nah, I didn't cry. But
I almost cried.
It.
I love it.
It was sad. I think a lot of people are going to be getting the
boa.
It's bao, because the Chinese word for dumpling is baozi.
Homie brought a white girl home too. Yeah, I see.
I know. I thought it was pretty funny. I was like, of course he brings a white girl home. And I was in an audience filled with Asians too, and I was sitting next to this Asian dude, and I wanted to be like, "Hey, is that offensive to bring a white girl home or something? Is this like an inside joke
offensive,
or something?"
Yeah.
To you?
Yeah, it was beautiful, Austin.
Yeah, San Francisco all day.
I did like it better when I thought that the dumpling actually brought it home. You know, then, I mean, it was sweet. At
dumpling
the end,
got gay.
But I was like, man, wow.
I mean, that dumpling is so cute. I mean, you know, it's got some a leg up. All right, so this next one is from Alan. He said, long-time fan, first-time caller. Just wanted to say that Screenslaver equals Ted Kaczynski, a.k.a. the Unabomber. Notice some parallels between. It would be cool if you mentioned when you do a video about it.
Yeah, the outfit, for sure.
I don't know much about the Unabomber, so I can't really address this. Do you know a lot about him?
Yeah. I mean,
I feel like
I've heard things, but I feel like he's probably referring to when Screenslaver says we're all living inauthentic lives instead of, you know, being.
Yeah. So because Ted Kaczynski was really influenced by this movement that's called anarcho-primitivism. There's a guy named John Zerzan, who's actually a pretty well-known anarcho-primitivist philosopher, who talks about how technology is essentially embedded within the exploitative capitalist system, which accelerates our alienation and things like that. And so Ted Kaczynski, he was an academic. He has like a fucking PhD in math or some shit like that. You know, just a brilliant thinker who went deep down the rabbit hole of thinking that we were living in a society that was hyper real, that was disconnected, that needed to get back to nature. And, you know, that's why he went out into the woods himself. Because anarcho-primitivism wants to argue that the solution is to actually go back. So, you know, they do have a nostalgic image, even though they might say that it's not about going back, that it's about going forward to create more authentic realities in the future. But it oftentimes really is rooted in this sort of idea of a primitive connection
to the
real.
Okay, yeah, so ideology-wise, yeah. But, I mean, but the Unabomber was sending bombs to government employees and stuff, which is, that's where I thought he was going.
Yeah, I think it's just the manifesto is what he's talking about. Fun piece of trivia, my sister has a friend whose father is one of the guys who defused the last Unabomber bomb. Yeah.
Damn.
He's a gangster. Anyway, so this next one is from Lee. So Lee sent us a message about his reading of the movie. I'm interested in what you guys think about this. He says that the movie is about radical atheism. He says Evelyn has a conversation with Elastigirl where she espouses that she thinks people will always lean on the easy way out. A conversation, by the way, where Elastigirl alternates between viewpoints of cynic and believer. When Evelyn reveals that she's the bad guy, it comes attached to the line, "You make us worse." She goes on to disparage her father for attempting to reach out to superheroes instead of hiding like her mother during a robbery. What she's suggesting is that her father's belief in a higher power, in this case superheroes, led him to take the easy way out and lean on the supernatural instead of taking action for himself, and this got him killed. She also criticizes her brother's naivete. She says that in his mind, superheroes went away, then mom and dad went away. Maybe by bringing back superheroes, he can bring back their parents. This seems to be arguing about the disillusionment one feels upon growing up and realizing God might just be made up. They give people an easy way out in the same way religion gives people an easy way out. As long as people think superheroes exist, they'll give up their agency to them. In other words, as long as people are believers, they are the worse for it.
Fuck, I'm taking that. I believe that now.
Thank you. You're on board.
Yeah, that's a good way to read this movie. Yeah.
But I think that it's more to the point that we were bringing up earlier, in that the way that, I mean, this is taking it to a level of, you know, like, I don't think that when people go to the movies and watch a superhero movie, they're like, you know, literally like worshiping Christ. But I do think that there is an element of, you know, belief in transcendent individuals that can save us all. But I don't see the religious thing as much, but I think that there's overlap with what we're trying to say.
I mean, I can see him, you know, the dad using the phone as like, I'm praying, I'm getting on my knees and I'm using the telephone to pray to God, and yeah, God's not there, and then he gets killed. I can see that. Yeah.
It's like Christian Scientists.
Yeah, real quick, yeah, too.
Yeah, I mean, so the only thing I'd say is that I think, you know, it's an interesting take, and I'm here for it. I dig it. But the only thing I'd say is, Lee, you know, let's challenge ourselves even further, and let's be more self-critical and analyze how even in our rejection of theism, are we actually, and, you know, this is what Jared was just saying, is are we actually getting to some sort of authentic materialist connection with the truth, or have we just displaced our worship? Or what they would say in psychoanalysis is that we've desublimated, we've removed it from its transcendent figures, but infused it into other ones, immanent ones. So now, you know, we worship our TV shows, our TV heroes, or in alignment with this episode, with we worship our superheroes. Or, you know, every time you click like, or every time you repost something on social media, is that an act of worship or glorying, you know? And there are a lot of people out there that are exploring the ways that we used to worship. You know, you pray to the saints or to Mary, or you sing worship songs on a Sunday or whatever, and how that's just transformed into different forms of worship and glorying. You know, now we go to a football game, or you go to a Bieber concert or whatever, and you get the same sort of sensationalist connection to something transcendent. So, you know, maybe we should just challenge ourselves and ask whether we've actually broken free from our delusions, or, you know, have we just subsumed ourselves under different masters?
And see, when I see a bunch of people go into a superhero movie, I don't see people worshiping superhero Jesus. I see a bunch of people that just want to go see shit get blown up, and there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that.
And that is ideology. Nothing wrong with that, motherfucker.
All right, so I want to read one more, and this is from JJ. It's either JJ Jesus or JJ Jesus, and this guy is a sick fuck just like me, because this guy likes to think about the Matrix. So first off, JJ studied at West Point, and he's now a captain in the Army stationed in Korea. So first off, I want to say, JJ, thank you for your service. So he says he really enjoyed the discussion about The Matrix Reloaded. He had two questions that tie into this discussion. One, in the second film, we learned that Neo and Zion, who we used to view as system-defying rebels, are actually just known variables in a larger system. We also learn that machines are subjugated to the system as well, with the most oppressed programs being regularly deleted. The real rebels, then, are actually two different machines, Smith and the Merovingian. Smith seems to be consumed by a loss of purpose and the notion that the purpose of life is to end, but he is a true unknown variable within the machine system and wants to destroy it. Similarly, the Merovingian is operating outside the system. He seems to be profiting off the oppression like a sort of mob boss, but he also helping the program seek refuge from the agents. So what does the Wisecrack crew think about the meaning of these two figures within the context of the machine system? So thank you for your question, JJ. Let me first start with Smith. So I agree that there is a great argument to be made here that Smith is the only one that is truly detached from any kind of system and makes his own choice. I actually think there's more validity to that fan theory that Smith is the one than most fan theories. But I will say the one thing that's odd about this is that during the architect scene, the architect tells Neo that if the one does not reinsert his code into the source, then the matrix will continue to decay. And then Neo says, Smith. And then the architect says, exactly. So I'm wondering, like, it's unclear. It seems like Smith is the one unique thing that is happening during this cycle. Now, it would make more sense if after Neo decided to save Trinity instead of reinsert his code into the source, then Smith started coming about. And then everyone's like, oh, shit, this has never happened before. What do we do? But it was before that Smith started replicating himself. And so I don't really know how to take that, because it seems like Smith is part of the system because the system needs to decay because it's part of the mathematically imperfect equation. Now, the Merovingian, similarly, like, would the Merovingian not also suffer because of Smith? Like, isn't it in his best interest to keep the system going? Because otherwise, he's not going to have any criminal empire, and he's not going to be able to rebel against shit if Smith goes and, you know, like, turns the entire matrix into a bunch of Smiths. So that's kind of why I'm confused about that.
I think you nailed it.
I got it, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just here as a passive observer right here.
All right, yeah, shit, I wish Rebecca was here. All right, so one more question from JJ. He says, in the first film, do you think the Wachowskis plant any hints at this larger system or lay any groundwork for the themes in the second film, or do you think they came up with all this after the fact? I believe they came up with it all after the fact. I think that chances are they never thought that they'd even get the movie made, never mind get to make sequels, you know? So I think that just on a very practical level, they just tried to make the best movie they could. And then when they realized how much of a cultural impact they had, they said, all right, what's next?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I think they actually had these planned.
Lucas style?
Yeah, well, I don't know about the third one. I definitely think the second one, though, they already had ideas. I don't know if it was storyboarded out or...
They're half of one movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it felt like that, you know, and how similar, well, I guess, I mean, the second one, I didn't, yeah, well, if we're just going to answer the question, yes, I do think they had the second one planned out. I don't think they had the third one planned out, or if they did have the third one planned out, it wasn't as good. I do think they had the second one.
See, I wonder if it's less conscious, because, you know, we were talking last week or whatever about, you know, what they were, you know, how they were so successful after the first one that they were like, well, fuck, you know, we got to one up ourselves now or whatever. And you know, I don't doubt that they had that conversation at some point, you know, that they were aware of the expectations and needed to make sure that they didn't let things fall through the cracks. But, you know, I think sometimes things are more unconscious or kind of part of who you are in your being, let's say. And so I wonder if for the second or third films, if the themes that came out that are more explicitly political or progressive or critical, you know, I'm not sure that they sat down and were like, you know, well, we need to now make sure that we expand on these progressive political themes and make Neo a superhero of the left or whatever. I don't even know if it was that conscious. You know, it may have been more that they built a world that had its own internal logic based on the expression of who they are in their habitual selfhood as people and as artists. So maybe they just wanted to build on things and make it visually and conceptually interesting as it's sort of contained within this authentic logic that flows from their inner selves. You know, and of course to make something fun and artistically cool. But yeah, I think it was probably more something like that. So yeah, they had it planned, but not in a formal storyboarded sense, like you were just saying.
Yeah, it wasn't written down. But you know, you shoot some things and you're like, man, if I shot the second one, this is what I would do with this one.
Yeah, you've always got stuff going on exactly, in your head, you know, like, you know, they probably don't sleep at night, you know, or when they were thinking about the next movie, you know.
To your point, Austin, about the progressive thing, I mean, their first movie was a lesbian exotic thriller in like a...
Which is so good,
it's so awesome, Bound. Yeah, you got to see it, you know. So I think that that's always been in every one of their movies. in a good way.
Especially Speed Racer.
Oh, yeah, especially
I'm kidding.
Yeah, it's just who they are.
Did he make Speed
But, yeah, no.
Yeah.
Right, I mean, yeah. It's just like Zack Snyder is going to infuse a little bit of objectivism and his Ayn Rand stuff in whatever he's doing. And isn't he doing...
He's the Fountainhead.
Yeah, he's doing the Fountainhead. I mean, can't, you know, those things just come out. It's just part of who you are as an artist. It's like a fingerprint that you can't avoid stamping onto a piece that you produce. I mean, and it's damn near impossible to avoid doing that. And shoot, why would you want to do that? That's the whole point of being an artist, is to infuse yourself into your piece of work. So I think that's what they were doing.
Yeah. Cool, guys. Well, we're going to wrap it up. First of all, where can we find you guys on the internet? Ryan.
You can find me at Ryan Shorts on Facebook and YouTube. And hell yeah, I love you.
You can find me at Greg the Grouch on Twitter and gregcomedy.com.
All right, and Austin.
Yeah, you can hit me up on Twitter, Austin_Hayden.
All right, hit me up on Instagram, @FatherWoody, for some killer dog pics. And until next time, I believe, next week, we're getting really bad at picking the movies beforehand, because we had something planned and then it got reshuffled, so I don't know what we're doing next week, but we'll put it on Twitter or something so you guys will be informed. So thank you guys for listening, and we'll see you later. Thanks, guys.
Peace.
Goodbye from Hollywood, California.
Laters.